Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the fava beans to my Chianti, it's Dan. How you doing tonight, Dan?
I'm doing pretty outstanding. You?
I don't know if I'm outstanding, but I am excited, more so than usual for one of our podcasts, because this is a new venture we're trying tonight.
Yeah. We've kind of wanted to do this for a while, so it's I've been looking forward to it.
Right. I mean, we've done podcasts specific to, you know, of course, Mad Men. That's where we got our start, and we did Better Call Saul. And we've done a few Game of Thrones ones, and of course, all those lovely Flash ones that we are doing now. But yeah, tonight we are venturing into new territory. We are doing our first ever exclusively Hannibal podcast. Now, I remember did you fall in love with the show last year? Was that when you caught up with it, or was that a little bit before that? I don't recall.
Yeah, I guess I'll just explain the thing. When they first announced the show, I didn't really pay much attention because I was like, wow, that's a really stupid fucking idea. I mean, and there was around the time that a lot of the shows would be pitching ideas for things like this that just seemed like just a dumb idea. And it's like, you know, why the hell are they doing that? So I didn't really give it much crap, whatever. And so I didn't bother watching it. Well, then, like, everybody watched the pilot, and they were all just like, oh, you know, I didn't hear anybody say the pilot, like, just wasn't awesome. So, but by then, it was too late. I hadn't recorded it, and the NBC didn't have their, like, thing then. At least as far as I know, they didn't have their thing where you could just watch the episode online the next day. So I was just behind, and I wasn't going to start watching the show without watching the pilot. I always have to watch everything in the right order, so I waited for the Blu-rays to come out. I bought them, and for whatever reason, the Hannibal Blu-rays are really inexpensive. I mean, I think I paid like $15 a season per season, and that's cheap for this kind of media, and considering the quality, it's a really good deal. But so I bought that, and I mean, it probably took me 3 days to pound through season one, and I was hooked. I mean, pretty much right away. I mean, you know, I like shows that are kind of shot in this way where, you know, they kind of have like a little bit different, like maybe like a bluish filter, you know, kind of like House of Cards does, just has that shot where it just feels cinematic. And I really like the look, and it just has that. And then when you add up everything else about the show, the acting and the writing and the way they just, you know, make everything look all creepy and just everything, it's my kind of thing. So I didn't, by the time I finished the first season, it was to the point where I'm just like, okay, this is like my favorite show on TV, except Mad Men, because I didn't watch season one until after Breaking Bad was already over. And then unfortunately I missed the beginning of season two again. I wasn't prescient enough to record the episodes before I watched the first season. So once again, I had to wait, I think it was like 10 months or something before the season two Blu-rays to come out before I was able to watch that. And then I digested those in like 48 hours. And then after that ridiculous, ridiculous fucking cliffhanger, then I had to wait another, you know, forever before last night to happen. And then I didn't bother setting the DVR to record Hannibal because I just didn't pay attention to the fact that I've never watched it on TV before. So I had to wait and watch it at 5:30 in the morning because I didn't fucking record it.
That was so, yeah. Probably more of an anecdote than I was expecting there. Had you been a fan of the character or anything before the show? Had you, like, from the movies or the books?
I'd read Red Dragon. I don't think I read any of the other ones, to be honest with you, but I'd seen the movies. I mean, except for whatever the stupid last one was, the one where it's like a young Hannibal. I didn't pay any attention to that at all.
I would just ignore that one and move on. Pretend it didn't exist.
Yeah, well, that's true. So, but I've seen the other ones, including Manhunter. So, I watched Silence of the Lambs, you know, before anything else, and I enjoyed it. And then for some reason, I don't really remember why, but I ended up going to. I'm not the type of person that goes to a lot of movies in the theater, but for whatever reason, I saw Hannibal and Red Dragon in the theater, and I liked them both. You know, Hannibal definitely was inferior to Silence of the Lambs. But I liked Red Dragon a lot. I watched Manhunter. I mean, I probably watched it on DVD. And I enjoyed that too, even though it had that really weird kind of, you know, 80s vibe. I mean, that, like, you know, that synthesized music and all that stuff. But I enjoyed it. And it was kind of at the same time I was watching CSI. So it was kind of weird seeing William Peterson, you know, in like super skinny, like goofy 80s hair doing that after seeing, you know, Edward Norton do the same thing.
Right. Well, for me, first and foremost, Red Dragon has always been one of my favorite books of all time. I read it as a kid in high school. I might have been before high school, actually. It's one of the few books I've read several times. It was actually my mother's copy. I stole it when I moved out when I was 18, so I still have that same copy in my own bookcase now. She never listens to these podcasts, so who cares? still have it here. So my love first starts with the book. Then the first book, first and foremost, then Silence of the Lambs, a great follow-up book, certainly more cinematic feeling when you read the book than even Red Dragon was. It feels like it's written as though it was about to be made into a script, you know, very quick clipped chapters and so on. Hannibal, the third book, let's just say I like the first half, maybe even two thirds, and I despise the rest of the book. I've not read, I believe there was another book that came out. Maybe it's connected to that movie that you're referring to, the Hannibal Rising, kind of like a prequel. I never read it. I don't really have an interest in reading it. I've never heard anything good about it, and I just don't care. So in my mind, until it's not even a trilogy, it's like 2.5 books as far as I'm concerned.
Maybe at some point I'll read Silence of the Lambs. I think I read Red Dragon because Stephen King had recommended Black Sunday, and I read that first, and then somehow I must have decided to pick up Red Dragon after that.
Right. Yeah, I've read Black Sunday. I think I have that in paperback as well. So then you have the movies. Manhunter, I believe I did see that in the theater. I know I did because I was all hot to see it because of the book. That's one of those movies that I probably had very little appreciation for when I saw it as a teenager, because I was of the age where I was just upset that it wasn't enough like the book to suit my taste at the time. It is very 80s, but you know, the book was written in the 80s, so it kind of makes kind of sense in a way. That was like one of Michael Mann's early films. I mean, I know he had already done Thief at that point, and I think maybe a couple others. I don't remember for sure. But it's got some very interesting things going on in it. It's the soundtrack. You mentioned the synthesizer. It's kind of a great soundtrack. It's really, very highly regarded. It's very powerful and weird.
It's really moody, really, and it was really effective and kind of, it worked.
Very, very much so. And of course, then you had Silence of the Lambs, which, you know, need one say anymore. Jonathan Demme, Oscar-winning movie. I think Tak Fujimoto was the cinematographer.
It's great cinematography in that movie.
It's an iconic movie. People quote it all the time. It's the movie that put Anthony Hopkins was always a well-regarded actor, and he had done, you know, he'd been working for decades before that. That's the movie that made him a star. That's what made him a household name to everybody. That's his iconic role. And although Brian Cox did well with the role in Manhunter, and some people even prefer his little bit in Manhunter, and I understand why, but Anthony Hopkins really took the role and did something with it. And obviously, because he's the guy who kept playing him in the next couple movies. As for Hannibal, the movie, well, I already said what I said about the book. So the movie actually does not annoy me as much as the book, but it still was left me wanting. Maybe I couldn't adjust to a different actress playing Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
Because it was Julianne Moore instead of Jodie Foster. So that, and Jodie Foster was, I think, as equally iconic as Hopkins was in her part. So it was really hard to see someone else playing that part for me at the time. Okay, but it wasn't great.
Yeah, I mean, at least they made the effort to cast a good actress, but I mean, it's just difficult to, you know, replace something like that.
Right. As for Red Dragon, I've discussed that movie on other podcasts in the past, so I won't spend more than 30 seconds about it. I even think we talked about it in one of our own podcasts recently. It's a movie with a great cast. It's a movie that follows the book fairly closely. But it's the movie I always use as evidence of this is what happens when you don't have a really good director. Because they just, for the cast they have for that movie and for how closely it follows the story, that should have been one of the greatest movies of all time, as far as I'm concerned. And it was far from it. It was just kind of, it was just there.
Yeah, it's just like serviceable.
Yeah, and when you have a movie, again, I know I just said this recently, but I don't care. You have a movie where the cast has Ralph Fiennes and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ed Norton and Anthony Hopkins. It's like, holy crap. that's an A-list cast, you know, but pretty deep. Harvey Keitel is in it too, if I recall.
They have great material to work with. I mean, those roles are all just fucking awesome.
Right. Again, I liken it to, it's actually more egregious because I always bring up when Gus Van Sant did that shot for shot remake of Psycho and how it just doesn't work, even though it's pretty much exactly the same script. It's exactly the same shots even, and it just doesn't work. But of course, Gus Van Sant at least has talent. We've seen him do other things. Brett Ratner, the director of Red Dragon, is pretty much a Hollywood hack who's just got a lot of friends in the right places. So anyway, getting to the TV show, when I heard they were going to be doing a TV show based on the character and the whole Will Graham thing as well, I'm going to sound kind of like the way I did before The Flash started. Let's just say I was skeptical, to put it mildly, because I was like, oh, you're going to dumb it down for TV? It's going to have that TV kind of look and feel? I don't want to see that, especially when I knew it was going to be on NBC. I mean, at least if it had been announced it was going to be on like HBO or something, I would have a little bit of faith. But NBC was not making me feel good about it. And then I saw the pilot. And I was, this isn't NBC. What is this? This isn't network TV. And then I watched episode after episode. And you could, at least in the first season, you could see some glimmer of network TV's way of doing things as far as the formatting of the show, because it does have a certain slight procedural element to it. You know, the case of the week or a killer of the week or victim of the week, however you want to phrase it. Although they do get away from that by the time we hit season two more. But everything from the cinematic look, the music, the tone, the feel, the lighting, all screams movies. I mean, I was like, wait, did they get David Fincher to do this? Is this David Fincher? Come on, is he ghost directing? Is that it? Is that what's going on here?
And it wasn't just like the pilot. Like, we've seen a lot of stuff where they just do a really nice pilot and then it's just like, you know, normal after that. I mean, they just didn't let up ever. And that's not something we see super often.
No, it's consistent episode after episode. I thought it was fascinating when people were going, losing their, well, I guess you cursed, I guess I'll curse, losing their shit over a show like True Detective, which I did appreciate and admire a lot. But I was also thinking, hey guys, you know, I've seen a show lately that equals, if not better, as this as far as an amazing cinematic look, and it's on NBC. It's called Hannibal. Maybe you guys should check it out. So, yeah, I liked the first season a lot. I really liked, especially the lead actor for Hannibal Lecter, Mads Mikkelsen. I knew him only from Casino Royale before that. He was the bad guy in that. I like that they chose an actor who doesn't resemble or make you think of Hopkins or that style of acting at all. They went in a totally different direction with it. And I think that was a brilliant move on their part, because we're never thinking about that actor at all. I've never thought about Anthony Hopkins at any point watching this. And that's saying something, because he's playing such an iconic role. You know, the closest thing I could think of is Heath Ledger taking over the Joker after people would remember Jack Nicholson's portrayal of the Joker years earlier. And Ledger just did such a different job with it, a totally different type of character where you weren't even thinking about what Nicholson had done, you know, decades earlier. I think that's what this actor is doing with Lecter here. He's doing it in such a different manner, while still being the, obviously, the incredibly cultured and intellectual character that Lecter is. He's still Lecter, but there's something about his presence, his alien-like presence, which really works nicely on the show.
Oh, yeah.
So what's interesting is I know when we talk about other TV shows or movies, we sometimes get into the whole changing things from the books. And I like to think that over the years I've matured more than when I was a kid, or even in my 20s for that matter, where I don't mind a creator taking creative license with something if they're still staying true to the spirit of the books, of the story, of the source material. If at least you still have the same vision, but you choose to just go in a different direction with it, I'm fine with that. Whether it's a show about zombies, or it's Game of Thrones, or which I don't read the books, so who cares, or a comic book show, or anything. So, and that's kind of the way I feel about Hannibal. I mean, they have certainly have made changes from the books. I mean, first of all, a lot of what we've seen in the previous seasons takes place before the books really get started. Some of them, because we don't really see the early Lecter Will Graham relationships in the books so much, except told like in passing, of like almost flashback style in Red Dragon, if I recall. But they're really maintaining that same gothic creepy tone. I mean, good lord, this episode we just watched, I mean, the music alone was just like, it's like the 21st century Dracula's Castle kind of music. Was so intense and amazing. But I was, you know, doing a little bit of reading up on the show before we started the podcast, and something that I had forgotten about, I knew when I was watching the previous seasons that, you know, they had taken one character from Red Dragon, the reporter, Freddie Lowndes, and who was like a sleazy, you know, tabloid reporter from whatever local newspaper, you know, disgusting guy. And they made him into, you know, a woman. That he was like some still kind of a reprehensible character to a certain extent, but not quite as bad. But, you know, an internet blogger or columnist type of a thing. Then it turns out I read a little further, and they've taken several characters from the books that were men and turned them into women for the show. Like, I forgot that Dr. Alan Bloom is turned into Dr. Alana Bloom, who obviously was kind of a major character in the first two seasons, and we are waiting to see if we're going to see her this season. I don't remember if we saw her in that trailer at the end or not.
Yeah, I haven't been watching the trailers, but I believe her name is still in the opening credits, whatever that means.
It'll be interesting, although I don't really want to jump ahead, but who cares? It'll be interesting to find out that after the end of season two, which left everybody bleeding to death or dying, if none of them actually died. So I was pretty sure she was the one who was going to buy it.
Yeah.
Still might be. But one other one I wanted to mention, which I had no idea, the character that Cynthia Nixon played, we saw last season, the, you know, she's kind of like that prosecutor, the attorney general person. Her name was, I think, Kate Purnell or Prunell, something like that. Her name is actually an exact anagram of Paul Krenler, who was the obnoxious assistant attorney general who appeared in both Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal, the books. And people would remember in the movies because he was in Hannibal. That was the Ray Liotta character who, stuff happens to us at the brain. Anyway, I just thought it was kind of an interesting phenomenon that they had changed so many characters that way. And it was either I didn't remember it or I didn't care, because it doesn't matter. Because it's, again, it's staying true to the story, the spirit, the gender issues in these characters. It really doesn't matter. Another thing I was looking into that I remember talking about in previous seasons was this show, the creator behind the show is Brian Fuller. That's the guy who did, like, Heroes. The thing I like that he did the most was Pushing Daisies. I think he also did a show called Wonderwalls, which I have not seen, but I've heard of. I'd like to check out one of these days.
Yeah, I've heard good stuff about that.
I love Pushing Daisies. I just love that the guy who's Pushing Daisies, which is about as bright and colorful a show that has ever been conceived in the history of television. I'm telling you, it makes The Flash look like Hannibal. It's that bright and charming and light a show. If you want to see what Lee Pace is like when he's not being Don Draper light, you should check him out on Pushing Daisies. He's just like the nicest guy who ever lived. Anyway, back to the original plan for Hannibal. He had this whole thing mapped out that there were going to be shorter seasons, and he mapped out that there would be 7 seasons. So, for example, when he got to season 3 was supposed to be basically the origin of Lecter, which would feed into season 4, which would be about Red Dragon, 5 would be about Silence of the Lambs, 6 would be about Hannibal, and 7 would be the way to kind of resolve how Hannibal ends and the entire story overall. But I guess the feeling is he's thinking that 7 seasons might not be in the cards for this show. I mean, it's a semi-miracle they keep renewing it, and that's more because it's a foreign distributor that's really footing most of the bills for this show, so NBC has made a deal with them to keep it on. It's a very strange deal. I don't know all the terms of it. One of these days I should really look it up before a podcast so I actually know what the hell I'm talking about.
Have you checked the ratings for this premiere now that they've shifted it from Fridays to Thursdays, which is a better slot? And yet
I did not have time today to check anything like that.
Well, so we'll look it up. We'll look it up for the next podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. See how it compares to previous seasons. And
it'd be nice if you know it doesn't get any awards, but the critics love it and it's just such a good show. It'd be nice if it built like so many other shows that we've seen that just get stronger and stronger as the seasons go along. And
it would be nice, although it's interesting because you'd want that to happen, though a premiere like this, which although I thought very highly of, might have been a difficult one to really for newbies to wrap their head around, but we're almost there. We're gonna get there. We're a couple minutes from there. So what I was trying to say was, since he's not really feeling he's gonna get 7 seasons out of this, he's made plans to kind of start merging storylines and ideas together. So. Right. Certain things are being rushed. I'm not saying they're rushed because that means I'm being negative about it. But he's changed things to a certain extent. So like this season, there are definitely going to be elements and aspects of, you know, the first book, Red Dragon. We're also having parts of Hannibal in here, and things that are even, like I saw in this very episode, kind of playing with the idea of Hannibal, kind of almost an homage to Hannibal.
Oh yeah, so, we've already used stuff from Hannibal last season. So.
Yes. Right, but the stuff that they used last season to a certain extent could have been seen as a precursor to Hannibal, because it's almost like the origin of characters that we will see in Hannibal. But and also there are even aspects of that Hannibal Rising thing, which I again don't have any interest in checking out. The really big thing that's going on behind the scenes is it's the big mystery of the show is whether Brian Fuller can finally actually land the rights to Clarice Starling. Apparently the rights to that character are held by MGM. They were able to get the rights to Lecter and all these other characters, but Starling is still an issue. They want the rights to that character. I mean, he's made jokes about it because we'll just have a character and we'll name her, you know, Shmarice Schmarling or something. Because you can make certain changes, but you kind of want to have one of your biggest protagonists in your series to be there. I mean, after Will Graham, it's Clarice Starling really takes over the story. And my dream was always, if Hannibal had been written the way I wanted it to be, that it would have been Will Graham and Clarice Starling combining forces to go after Lecter. I always thought that was what should have happened instead of what we got. But that's a story for a future podcast, perhaps.
Maybe that's something we will get.
That will make the bad taste of Hannibal go away so nicely for me if that should happen in the future. So let's actually get to why we're here, which is the actual first episode of season 3, which I believe the title is Antipasto. That's right. Since at least the first half of the season will have titles that are of Italian origin, be they food or related to culinary things, I will try to hit them with an Italian affectation, which means I'll sound like a moron. Before we get into the recappity kind of a thing here, without getting too much into our opinions of the episode overall, did you have any problems following the episode or really latching on to what they were doing as the episode unfolded?
No, not really. I mean, if they wouldn't have showed the Eiffel Tower at the beginning, I just would have assumed he was in Florence the whole time, so there was that. But no, I mean, there was enough there where I was able to follow it.
Okay. Well, I figured my notes are kind of written as I'm watching it, so it's funny when I write my notes and then I look back at them. Sometimes I'm writing notes and I'm wondering about things which then become evident like 15 minutes later. So I never know if I should leave that in if I'm doing the podcast or just whatever. I'll just wing it and see how we go here. So you're right. We open with a motorcyclist that's zipping through the streets of Paris. And as we suspect from the get-go, it's Hannibal. Looking, you know, like Mr. Cool in his little leather outfit and whatever.
I thought at least until they showed him that there was a chance that it was Will just zooming around, you know, searching, already on the hunt for Hannibal. But I wasn't particularly surprised it wasn't.
I knew it was him because I saw promo photos, you know, posters for the season, which had him in that leather jacket. So I knew.
Yeah, and I've stayed away from all the material, so.
If it's a poster in a subway station, it's really hard.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's right there. Okay.
Subway station? What's that? Is that where cows go to get milked? I don't understand.
Are you our friend from Kentucky now? Oh, here we go. I got to go to the outhouse. Oh, man. Anyway, back to Hannibal. Wow. Derailed a minute into the region. So, yes, and it's established that he's in Paris because we see the Eiffel Tower in the background. And then he walks into this party, and he's really drifting through the party. They do it in a very dreamlike way, which is something we're going to see throughout this episode. A lot of things are done to make you think you're in a dream because there's not just the surreal nature, because let's face it, that's been the hallmark of the show from the get-go. But things are done where it's almost... you almost question the reality of moments here and there. But as he's walking to the party, you see that his eyes are trained on this one guy, and we find out that it's a professor or doctor, Dr. Roman Fell. And I'll avoid the joke of the name being, Roman Fell, okay. A slightly younger guy notices him and approaches him. It's this guy named Anthony DeMond, and we find out he's a poet, which means he probably comes from money because he obviously doesn't do anything that earns any money. He introduces himself to Lecter, and this is where Lecter tells him that he's Boris Yakov. And they're talking about the Dr. Roman Fell guy, and it's clear that DeMond doesn't think much of him. Lecter's not really saying anything because that's Lecter's thing. He's kind of observing. He's kind of taking this guy, should he be taking this guy seriously? You know, what are his motives? That whole kind of a thing. I thought it was funny when the guy tells him to blink if you agree. Because I don't know if that was an inside joke or just a coincidence, but one of the famous things about Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of Lecter, specifically in Silence of the Lambs, if you ever heard him talk about it, was he never blinked. That was the key to his scenes in the cell with Jodie Foster, is that he would never blink in those scenes. I'm sure if you watch it, you will see him blink from time to time. I mean, because I think it's physically impossible not to blink. But he made every effort to not blink. So I just thought, I don't know if it was a coincidence, but I like to think of it as like a little inside joke there. One thing about this show, speaking of inside jokes, they do not pass up the opportunities to have Lecter have lines which are clearly alluding to what his proclivities are. I mean, when he has a line right here where he says, one can appreciate another's words without dissecting them. Okay, if you really think about that sentence, in the moment, the guy thinks he's talking about dissecting the words. But Lecter could really be talking about the another. You can appreciate someone without dissecting them. Which, as he says, though on occasion, dissection is the only thing that will do. Which, of course, we know he does that. Later on, we see him basically stalking that Roman guy. They exchange bonsoirs a couple times. And then we get another... Isn't this kind of a hallmark of the show as well? We get a little cooking montage. Don't we get that a lot on this show?
Yeah, that's their thing. Their creepy little cooking montage. Yeah, they almost, you know, in the way they shoot it, it's, I mean, it's not kind of, it's similar to the way they shoot the Dexter opening credits, where it's just, whatever they do, it just, you know, if they shoot it a little bit different frame rate or something, but it just makes everything, no matter what it is, even slicing fucking chives, just look creepy as hell.
And yet, I'll give you, it looks creepy, but it also looks damn tasty. Like, he's rarely ever cooked anything that I wouldn't be interested in sampling myself if I wasn't told what it actually was. You know, I would be a total sucker at any Lecter dinner party and, you know, and probably end up on the menu myself with my obnoxiousness. But anyway, we get that little cooking montage, and then, you know, he's seated eating. I guess he's cooked the guy's liver. I think he seared it with onions and such. So it's kind of almost like a diner dinner. But then a woman arrives to find him eating, and she says, bonsoir. I'm assuming she was next on the menu. And then we go to commercials. That was our little intro. And I got kind of a kick out of it. And I was going, are we not going to get back to what happened at the end of season two? But by the time we come back from the commercial, we're in this black and white sequence, which I have to confess, for a moment I was trying to figure out, wait, is this a flashback or is this a flash forward? And the Eddie Izzard character, Abel Gideon, did he keep him alive for a longer period of time than I realized? I was trying to figure out what was going on. It took me a couple minutes to gain my bearings here.
Yeah.
I did eventually realize at a certain point, oh, we're not gonna find out anything about Will Graham or Jack Crawford or anyone else. We're staying overseas.
Oh yeah, once we finished the second act and it was still just Hannibal, it seemed pretty obvious what they were gonna do. Even though we just saw Jack just for 1 second in a flashback.
Right. Although that flashback that you're referring to, I think it was one of the few flashbacks which was an actual clip from season two, as opposed to like the scenes with Eddie Izzard, which these were all new.
Yes.
Because when we left him with... it's hard not to call him Eddie Izzard. I know his character is Gideon, so I'll try to stick to calling him Gideon. When we last left him, he had a prisoner, and he had taken one of his legs, or he was feasting on one of his legs. So this is how we find out, oh, he kept him alive a lot longer. He just started devouring him bit by bit.
So it's just sharing him with him.
Yes, it's very nice. So I love Gideon's character here, how almost reflecting Lecter and how calm he is about the whole thing. He's hooked up to an IV. His legs have been cut off. He knows he's basically going to keep eating him until he's essentially dead. And he seems very...
glib.
Glib's an excellent phrase for it. And he kind of asks questions that I would confess I might think to ask a cannibal if I knew that I wasn't going to be eaten, at least. I love that he asked him, do we all taste different? Because I would wonder that. Any, you know, I think Hannibal's response is everyone has their flavor. I also liked in this moment when, because Gideon refers to cannibalism, and you can see that Lecter does not think of it that way. And he has that line where he says, it's only cannibalism if we're equals. Since Lecter doesn't see the people he kills and later eats as being equals to him, they are like, you know, animals to the slaughterhouse for him. He does think of himself being that on much a higher plane than they are. So I find that very fascinating about his character, and, you know, makes him probably scarier, quite frankly. Towards the end of this little moment, he's serving his leg to him. You know, he's done this thing where he's glazed with apples and thyme, candy apples and thyme, I think they use.
Yeah. For
Gideon doesn't really want to eat himself. You know, as lovely as the cubes of him look on the little toothpick, well, then I'm sure there's something more elaborate than toothpicks, but that's what it looks like. But I like that he has a line where he says that he doesn't want to spoil the fairy tale. Because he refers to Lecter being in his own little gingerbread house here. And I said, oh, gingerbread house, because that's where the witch lived, and she was all about eating the kids. So, you know, that was referring to a cannibal of, you know, legend, I guess. And then we get Lecter saying, you know, let it be a fairy tale. And then he looks at the camera and he says, once upon a time. And I went, wow, him saying once upon a time is cooler than any moment that was ever on the show, once upon a time. Take that show that didn't ask to be insulted on our podcast. So the color is restored, and we see that he's dancing with Bedelia. I guess it's Dr. Bedelia de Maurier. In other words, it's Gillian Anderson's character. And apparently they've taken over the identity of Dr. and Mrs. Fell, and we find out that he's been appointed to some really impressive institution there in Italy, the Palazzo Capone. And he's going to be like the translator and curator there. But there's already a guy kind of being a dick to him. You know, there always seems to be that one guy. You know, like in the books and the movies and even the previous seasons, I think Dr. Chilton was kind of that guy. Kind of like, now here in Italy, there's another one. You know, so Professor Sogliato, I think his name is.
Yes.
He's a smug little bastard. Pretty much. You know, and he's, you know, he challenges him because he's not impressed with him. But then he goes on this stupid thing of like, you know, would a non-Italian even recognize a note from like Dante, the famous writer himself? And I was like, well, I think he would. But then as he's going to go off to dance with Bedelia, Hannibal, you know, suddenly recites in Italian like Dante's first sonnet to, I guess, the Inferno, I guess, you know, to the entire room, the hushed crowd, you know. And he mentions that the sonnet deals with the eating of a heart. Of course it does, Hannibal. Of course. You can't let 5 minutes go by without some reference to eating someone. That's just what he does. But for some reason, we love it when he does it and we don't roll our eyes. But if Captain Cold makes one more crack like that on the Flash, I'm like, all right, enough already. So, I guess there's something that happens where he's going to give some lecture as kind of like as proof that he can do the job. I was a little confused by this. Not really confused. I was like, but they already gave him a job. So, why would he care about proving things basically to this one guy? Because everybody else is clearly taken with him, you know, just this one guy. But whatever. Later, what we guess is their home. I'm assuming it might have been the Italian home of where Dr. Roman Fell would have lived, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, they give homes to whatever he's doing, a professor or whatever his title is. I think they have, you know, residences for people like that. I'm sure he's just occupying whatever one the original doctor was supposed to move into.
Yeah, that would make sense. And good Lord, it was gorgeous. I gotta say something that I did not know until earlier today. I think someone sent me an article that was from Vulture.com or something. So I'm watching this episode, and it's gorgeous. And all I'm thinking during this episode is, geez, how much money are they spending on this show that they're going to Italy and they're shooting in all these places and look at these buildings and look at this, look at the architecture and look at the interiors. And it turns out that none of this was shot in Italy, that this was all shot in Canada and they all recreated it there.
No, I read some articles somewhere that they did film parts of this in both Paris and Italy.
Well, then I was lied to, and I'm going to...
Well, yeah, like, I know, like, the... I'm not sure exactly where I read it, and I'll try to find it, but I know, like, the some of the Florence exteriors, like, when Julian Anderson's character is, like, walking around outside, some of those, and, like, were they actually shot just a few scenes there.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually looking up the article I had read earlier today while you were talking. I was actually hoping you'd talk for another minute or two so I could actually find it to see if I just misunderstood it or they just got it totally wrong. Either thing is possible, quite frankly. I'm just trying to find it right now. Give me one second, because that was too big a boner to pull here. Here we go. Found it. Okay, it was the title of the article called Welcome to the Most Avant-Garde Season of Hannibal Yet. So let me just skim through this. Yada, yada, yada. This is great podcasting, me trying to read an article while we're talking.
Yeah. I'm also trying to look to see if I found to this in case I.
Oh, here we go. Got it. Okay, it was probably parts of it were shot in Canada because it mentions that it left the production designers the challenge of mimicking the old beauty of Italy on a soundstage in Toronto. The same obsessive attention to detail was evident in everything from building a facsimile of the Cappella Palatina, a Norman chapel from the 12th century in Palermo, to Hannibal's Florentine apartment. Quote, the production designer, we wanted to give it all a really rich, lavish feel through materials, millwork, furniture. Says Rory Shane, the production designer, we mainly used a lot of sienna. The color of Florence is so earthy, so we just wanted to keep the golden tones in the beginning. Then they start talking about the bath. So maybe it's the interiors were mostly shot in Canada, but they did go overseas to shoot some of the exteriors. It's not like there was a lot of exterior shooting in the episode anyway, but I believe that. That would make sense to me that they did that, because that would be much harder to recreate those the outdoor architecture.
Yeah, especially Florence. I mean, you know, Paris, he probably could do some, but I'm pretty sure, like, the shot they had at the Eiffel Tower, that too, which makes sense. I mean, being able to actually show that instead of having to, you know, throw it up in fucking Montreal or wherever.
Cool. Well, all right. So I'm sorry I sidetracked this there, but I was kind of curious. I had to know.
Hey, if we're going to go on a tangent, at least it's about actually, you know, the show we're talking about for once.
That is true. So back at their house, or the Roman's house where they're staying, we start getting the feeling for their relationship, which isn't quite what I thought it was. Because when we see them, you know, dancing at the party, they seem like a pretty dynamite couple. And it's kind of reminding us of how they looked when they were on that airplane at the end of season two. But here at the house, you realize things are not that great in this relationship. It's a very bizarre relationship, to put it mildly. And they keep feeding her these great lines, you know, that she says to Hannibal, like, you no longer have ethical concerns, Hannibal. You only have aesthetical ones, stuff like that. Because, you know, it's bad enough she's aware of what he does, you know, and what he's been doing, quite frankly. She's now fully expecting him to, you know, like, say, kill and thus eat that Professor Sogliato. But he kind of demurs on it because it wouldn't preserve the peace. So
plus, I think Hannibal kind of enjoys having somebody just, you know, to argue with every now and then.
Right, because he doesn't have Will Graham around. So in a way, she to a certain extent, she's almost providing a substitute for that. I mean, I guess in a way, she's kind of fusing both Will Graham and Alana into one character for him, because he's got the feminine side, you know, obviously, but he's also got, you know, the dueling nature that he always had with Will Graham. Although I don't really get the sense that there's a lot going on between these two at this point of a very physical nature. I mean, that's, I mean, I guess that is open to interpretation, but we certainly don't see anything happening between them. But either maybe that happened early on and isn't at this point, or maybe that's just not what this is about in any way, shape, or form. I don't know. I mean, I think their relationship seems to be very much based on power and control more than anything else, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, she's definitely trapped in his web somehow.
Which, in its own way, kind of sort of reminds me of one of the things about the third book, Hannibal, and his eventual relationship that develops with Clarice Starling. I won't say much more about that because maybe someone wants to read that book and maybe I shouldn't spoil it for them. Although I'll tell you right now, don't read it because I hate it. But but that's what it reminds me of. But she does, and especially when she says something to the effect where I think he's asking what kind of day she had. And she says that she's still in control of her actions. So I guess that makes it a good day or something along those lines. And she's acknowledging that one of Hannibal's key things is that he's always able to exert power and his will over other people. He does that all the time. That is one of the big things about Hannibal Lecter, is that he's able to persuade or convince or and control. It's what he does, I think. But I did wonder, when she says that, is she more lying to herself than anything else there? We then see her take a bath, and then it becomes, again, it's like we're plunged into a dream as we're watching her. She's plummeting through the depths of water, like it's just going on for miles and miles. It's kind of like an aquatic Dante's Inferno, I guess, because like kind of showing that she is in a form of hell, I thought. At least that's the way I interpret it. It is like a dream, so I guess it is open to interpretations.
Yeah, they shot that pretty well too. That was pretty fucking terrifying.
Oh yeah, and it was. Oh, and the music during that was just that really was like putting me on edge. Like I could feel like my hands just clenching while I was watching it. Even though like I know it's kind of a dream sequence, but it's making me very tense.
Well, yeah, it's like the music just sounds just right, so it just kind of makes you feel like you're tumbling like down into the abyss with her.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what they wanted us to feel. I mean, why else do you do it that way? Then we get the breather of a commercial. The reason I point that, and I know I don't usually like to make reference to commercial breaks when we're talking about TV shows, although we'll do it by accident from time to time, but this is such a cinematic form of storytelling that the commercials are almost like, ooh, they're jarring to have a commercial sometimes during the course of the show.
For me, it actually worked out missing it because for whatever reason, the NBC app didn't have any commercials for this. So I didn't have to watch any of their, you know, stupid crap that they insert in stuff at times. I just got to watch 40 whatever minutes straight.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So when they came back, what I referred to earlier when we were talking about it, we get an actual flashback from season two that little moment between Bedelia and Jack Crawford. And again, referencing what I was just saying about, you know, Lecter and his tendency to be in control, I think she says something to Crawford to don't be confused about who's really in control, meaning it's Lecter. Then we go into artsy land again with the show, where they start having these pretty shots of water dripping or splashing off Lecter, and then you realize the water is not purely water. He's cleaning off blood because you can. And there's a running motif throughout the episode of splashing water, splashing liquids, blood, champagne. Everything seems to be very similar to each other. We see that he walks into a room, he's toweling off, and he sees Bedelia is sitting on the bed with a gun, you know, pointed straight at him while she's calmly sipping a glass of wine. This was the scene that it clicked into place in my brain what they were doing in this episode. I don't know if it was this scene that it helped for you, or if you had already picked up on it before this or later. This was the scene where I realized, they are going to be bouncing back and forth throughout time during the course of this entire episode. There is no linear storytelling in this episode. These are all scenes that take place at different times, both before and after one another. And it's an interesting way to tell a story. I can understand why some might have found it confusing, but I think if those folks were to watch it again and know that going into it, it becomes a much more richer episode. It becomes that much better. I picked up on it at this point, and I realized, oh, and we're watching these flashbacks within flashbacks to inform other things. Because right. This scene, this is what takes place right after he's gone stabby stabby on everybody. And, you know, we know that because she asked him, is Will Graham still alive? And that's when you're like, oh, that's when this is taking place. Oh. It was at that point I realized, okay, I, like you, you know, I love this show, and I admired their style of filmmaking and everything else. But other than giving us flashes of something that was going to happen later in a season, they pretty much had told stories in a fairly linear fashion. So I thought they were just taking one more step into being that much more different than any other TV show, at least on network TV, by just jumbling things up here. So I like the fact that I had to pay that much closer attention to what was going on to understand it.
Yeah, and I like the way they do stuff. I mean, we see this kind of thing on other shows, and sometimes, you know, they do it well. Sometimes, you know, like Walking Dead, for example, they just don't quite get it right. But with a show like this, it really knows what it's doing. I mean, those scenes are inserted in those places for a really specific spot. I mean, all that stuff has to do with, you know, what Daphne's thinking at that point or what Hannibal's about to do next. And it's just the way they, you know, the way they layer it, it's delicious.
Right. And keep in mind, a lot of this episode, it's not simply just to let us know what Hannibal's been up to for the last few months. I felt a lot of this episode was to build up Bedelia's character, because we had only seen her, you know, in brief scenes here and there, you know, last season. She was very much, you know, at the center of this episode, I thought.
They definitely, now that she's upgraded to a full cast member, they definitely didn't waste any time really, you know, beginning to develop the character a lot more, instead of just having her be a cipher all the time and just saying, you know, interesting stuff and not doing much. I mean, they're showing stuff and planting seeds for other stuff that we don't know that'll, you know, explain the way she's, you know, why she's doing this.
Right. And yeah, if you're going to go through the trouble of getting Gillian Anderson to be on your show and again, like you said, be upgraded to, you know, a full cast member, then you better be doing something with that character significant. And I thought this episode was very significant for her character. Oh, I also loved, and refresh my memory if he, I feel like he used a line like this before, and he's referencing something he said in the past. When he's talking to her and he says that he has taken off his person suit and let people see him. Has he used that phrase before? It feels really familiar to me.
Yeah, that does sound familiar. I don't remember exactly where it would be, but I didn't have time to do a rewatch before this, of course.
Right. I should probably Google that, just that line. I feel like you said that in the previous season. I love the bizarre, simplistic yet poetic nature of it. And it's all that and yet creepy as all get out as well. So then we jump to seeing her shopping in this little Italian shop, and that was when I realized, oh, we're jumping around. Oh, by the way, I should stop calling it an Italian shop because they're in Italy. Every shop in Italy would therefore be an Italian shop, so it makes no sense to say that.
She was at a wine place in this scene, right?
Yeah, I think it was wine. Yeah, it's not the scene that's later on.
It was a butcher later, I think. Oh.
Yes. I wasn't sure if they were different places or not, actually.
Yeah, neither was I. I just didn't know why they'd have a dead rabbit hanging in a wine store. But, I mean, you know, I haven't been to Italy, unfortunately, so who knows?
Who knows what Italians do?
Yeah, crazy Italy. So
we see that Hannibal is working at what I presume is the Palazzo, and outside he runs into that Demand character again, that guy he saw in Paris at the beginning of the episode. And right now we know, okay, this guy's a loose end, because when Hannibal met him earlier, you know, he called himself, Boris Yakov? Was that the name they said earlier? And he's looking for that Roman guy, and He hasn't seen him. I mean, and I guess we get yet another one of the patented Hannibal Lecter cute little lines here. You know, my wife and I would love to have you for dinner. You know, this all goes back to the Hopkins line at the end of Silence of the Lambs. Having a friend for dinner. So it's, how many times are we going to rework that line, guys?
But, it's such a dark show. It's such a dark show. So it's nice when they do stuff like that. While it's still, you know, it's creepy as fuck. But if it, you know, makes me laugh out loud, so.
It helps. Yes, I do feel there are odd little moments of humor on this show that, not a lot, but enough so that I never feel like I need to, you know, take an antidepressant after I finish watching it or something like that. You know, I'm actually pretty happy after I finish watching an episode of Hannibal. It gives me ideas. Anyway. So, again, we're treated to another commercial break. And when we come back, we're back in the land of black and white with Gideon. We're now up to his arm. I was starting to wonder, are we going to keep... I wonder if every time we go back to him, he's going to be missing another body part. Is he just going to be a head? Is he just going to be a head? But...
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I just remember how your annoying neighbors moved away, and then you started posting pictures of you cooking dishes on Instagram. I'm just wondering if there's a coincidence there.
Yeah, it was weird because, Scott, I never knew you liked cooking Middle Eastern food before. that's an inside joke. Three people listening to the podcast will get. Everyone else will just, I don't know what he's talking about. Well, I'm referring to the ethnicity of my former horrible neighbors. Although why they were horrible had nothing to do with their ethnicity, so don't make me out to be one of those people.
Nope, that's a food joke, people.
Right, they were just loud and horrible. And tasty. Anyway, so... So back to black and white, and we see that, I love this bizarre thing, that there are snails. I guess they're munching away on his arm or thriving on it, quite frankly. It's, you know what, I'm sure there were some lines of interest or importance here, but all I could write was snails, snails, snails. I don't know why. What I wrote.
Yeah, and shooting snails close up. I mean, they're not exactly super pleasant to look at in the first place. But I mean, zooming in on them and knowing what they're doing, it was creepy.
It gave me a new respect for snails now. So, well, I also like, wasn't it on Hannibal that we had an episode where mushrooms were growing on a person? So
yes.
So now we've got mushrooms. Now we're getting snails. All sorts of fungi and little earth, little creature, slimy creatures. And let's get back to the show. So we're back in color. And they are having that fellow over for dinner. The entire scene, you're just watching Bedelia.
Oh, man.
Because she clearly knows who or what may be on the future menu here. And all I could think was, okay, is this the first time that she may be complicit in a murder? During this scene, I wasn't sure. That does become clear later on, but it does, in the moment, I wasn't sure about it.
And it was funny watching her seem. It seemed just so. I mean, you know, like it was difficult for her to eat her food. Just like whenever I'm trying to eat and watch Hannibal at the same time, I have to. It's really. I gotta push it.
Oh yes, I have a friend who maybe she'll even listen to this podcast for a change, who always seems to find herself eating when she's watching Hannibal. And I'm always like, really? Do you not know when you're going to be watching something while there's food in front of you? It's like, you're eating all of a sudden, wait, Hannibal's on? How did this happen? Are you not in control of this?
Yeah, I've got a strong stomach with stuff, but I mean, there was like last season, the scene, and it wasn't even particularly like showing anything brutal on screen, but I had to take the pizza that I was eating and take it and just put it in the other fucking room because I was just done. The scene where Will, or I can't remember if it's Will or Jack that discovers Dr. Katz's body like sliced into like a whole bunch of like, you know, super thin sections in the observatory.
Oh, yes.
Okay, you know, it was just too fucked up. I was just done. Not going to eat my food. Not going to eat pizza. And that's saying something for me. So.
I actually try to go out of my way to eat something while I watch the show because I'm hoping maybe it will spoiling my appetite, and thus I will eat less, and it can help me lose a little bit of weight or something. But surprisingly enough, you know, I can watch a guy eat his own nose, and it doesn't bother me while I'm eating. but back to this little dinner. I want to call it a dinner party, but I don't know if three make a dinner party. It kind of made me chuckle. It kind of reminded me of watching Breaking Bad when you had Walt and Skyler and Jesse all at the table together. And although, okay, it's not that good. I'm not going to go that far. But when you had the moment, there's that one moment. It's probably one of the top three funny moments I've ever seen on this show, period. when Damon asks, is it that kind of a party? And then Bedelia and Hannibal look at each other, because I'm pretty sure that thought had never occurred to them until he says that. And then he's like, it's not that kind of a party. And then she has to pipe in, no, it really isn't. I thought that was fabulous. Oh, one other thing to be noted during the scene, because it almost harkens back to the little black and white flashbacks. Damon notices that Bedelia is eating oysters, acorns, and marsala, which apparently was what ancient Romans would feed their animals to improve their flavor. So, of course that's what Lecter would be feeding people. Of course. But by the end of the scene, he lets him go. So he does not chow down on Damon that evening. Later we do see Bedelia at that shop again. And this is where we see that hanging bunny. I wrote bunny dripping blood. So I figured it was like, Easter.
Like, it'd be a strange thing to see out by out by the register. This is a blood dripping.
I thought it was a certain metaphoric value to it, because, is she thinking of herself being the innocent who's going, being led to the slaughter here? Is this a trapped animal? Is it representing the people that he's killed? There's so many ways to read that little thing, and you wonder what's actually going on in her own head, which is why that scene is there, I guess.
Yeah.
Then we get a couple really interesting things. We then see her at a train station. And, she's dressed in this whole blue outfit. She's got this whole kind of Carmen Sandiego kind of look going on here, I thought. And then she notices there's a security camera at the train station. And she looks directly at the security camera. I thought that meant something. Like, she was, in case someone should ever see her or identify her, because I don't know, maybe if she's considered a missing person because she left with Lecter or something. I thought that was what was going on there. At least that's the way I interpreted it. Did you think that?
Yeah, I thought it was just more of she's playing a little game there and just trying to draw attention to the fact that this is where Hannibal is.
Right, yeah. I just felt whether she means it as a call for help or screwing around. And yeah, based on things in the episode, I kind of think slightly more the former than the latter. I think she's very torn when it comes to
life. Well, we've seen her, we've seen her play little games before where she's giving out information she doesn't have to, and
sure.
Well, yeah, and she did. That's she specifically
true. I forgot about that.
When Will was in the asylum, I mean, she went out of her way to let him know that she didn't think he was crazy or whatever. I mean, pretty much just to fuck with Hannibal's plan.
Right.
But as to whether or not she's in that frame of mind right now, that's another story, because she's, she doesn't seem to be too Machiavellian at this moment.
No, she's not the one who's Machiavellian in this relationship so far.
Nope.
Then we see her, we just go to the next scene, which again, probably was confusing to people because it takes place at a totally different point in time. And that's the thing, that we keep going back and forth at different points in time, but there isn't the clear transitions for people. Outside of the black and white sequences, which are very clearly, separate, but the fact is that they have scenes that are in color that go back to back that take place totally out of sequence with each other. Because the next scene is when she wakes up on the floor next to that corpse, which I will confess, I was like, I had to rewind it. I kept going, is that is that Zachary Quinto? It really kind of looks like him. And then I believe I got confirmed about it when I was watching the end credits. Like, oh, that was him. That's weird. And we get this. So he's laying on the floor dead. She gets up. And then we get that really weird moment.
Yeah.
Where she's, it looks like she's pulling her arm out of his mouth. Which I was watching, like, is that even physically possible?
Yeah, I only watched. I was watching it on my tablet, and I didn't want to, I didn't want to mess up the recording and have it like, you know, I would not be able to get back to my spot, so I didn't rewind it to see what was exactly going on there. But yeah, what the hell was that?
See, what I said earlier about there being moments or scenes that you sometimes are not even sure what's reality and what's surreal, and I think they do that a little bit on the show to begin with, and I think they do that a lot in this episode. And that moment in this flashback to something that we've not seen before. I mean, obviously, I don't think she could have conceivably had her entire arm down this guy's throat and pulled it out. It just, how does that even work? So I thought it was just some weird, surreal moment, maybe just crap going on in her head. I don't know what that means.
I couldn't tell if she was pulling her own arm out or if she was pulling like his arm out, like if he'd like, you know, somehow, I don't know, it was.
I rewound it a couple times. It's her arm. I just don't, which made it that much more bizarre. Something bizarre in this show. How strange.
Well, yeah, it's no like full grown adult male, like, you know, flying out of the inside of a horse, but it was definitely creepy and disturbing.
Sure, what that means.
Well, it happened in the last season. Remember the episode with
I totally blanked on that. Okay.
I know. So, the Jeremy Davies episode wasn't very memorable.
You're saying that to instigate one listener. That's what our podcast has come down to. We're just making cracks to upset like one person. we're so professional. So back to this scene, what makes it equally weird is the way Lecter walks in. And in this moment, I realized, you know, Hannibal Lecter might be the, I guess I'll take your lead and curse for a change. Hannibal Lecter might be the calmest motherfucker I've seen on any TV show in years. he's always calm. He's always, you know, even when he may be in peril or danger, you know, like he was last season, he's very matter of fact. He's very pragmatic. And in this scene, it's like he walks in as though there's hardly anything, you know, out of the ordinary here.
Oh yeah, he's like a fucking T-1000. Even if he's fighting, he's just like, okay, what's going on?
And we find out in this little moment that this man, whoever he is, other than being, you know, Zachary Quinto, I guess, had attacked her, and we learn that he was a former patient of Lecter's, and now he's her patient. Right when she says that, instantly I was like, okay, I guess I know what happened here. Because what does Lecter do? He controls people. He comes as close as one gets to programming people as I've ever seen any fictional character in the last 30 or 40 years. So absolutely he was behind what happened here, I thought. I thought he put this plan into motion.
Oh yeah, he definitely set this up. So I'm looking. Presumably at some point they're going to get back to this and fill in the blanks. And and you just know it's gonna, you know, whatever he does, it's just gonna be. You just watch it and you're just gonna admire how freaking just much of a bastard he is.
Well, what he's doing in this one moment that we see, and again, this may have been another one of these things that might have been confusing the folks. What he says to her. Because you'd think he was there to comfort her and, you know, help her or whatever. But he says to her, he died under your care. You were not defending yourself. And I was like, whoa, what? And then I realized, oh, I got to pull out the curse word again. This is what Lecter does. He's in full-blown mindfuck mode here. He's totally screwing with her. But he's doing that so he can, again, gain control over her. I mean, that's because remember earlier in their previous seasons, they were, you know, doctors, and he was actually under her care, which implied that she was in a higher place than he was. And even though he might have liked her or admired her or whatever the phrase is, well, you can't have that. You know?
Yeah, just imagine, you know, he already had her under his control, and he's like just, you know, going to her as his psychologist just so he could like maintain that control. It's just
right. So then we switch back to another point in time. I guess we could say it's maybe the current timeline. Actually, I don't think it is, because I think we're in different parts of time throughout this whole episode. Because now we're at the part where he's doing the lecture about Dante, which mainly is about the hanging and actual evisceration of Judas. Of course, you know, I don't want to accuse a show that I love this much about being not so subtle. But yeah, they're not being very subtle here. Because, you know, throughout this episode, we're wondering if she will eventually betray him. You know, this, and she certainly has opportunities. Will she try to escape him? Will she betray him? So the fact he's doing this entire lecture that she's present for, and he's talking about the, you know, the death of one of the most famous turncoats and traitors in history, or at least, you know, religious history or whatever, is not an accident.
And the way they shot this scene too, and I'm sure you know what I'm going to say here, but when he's standing up in front of the projection and they have like eyes like just like right on his face, it just makes him look creepy as hell. It's just so awesome the way when they do stuff like that.
Oh yeah, it's just gorgeous. I mean, the cinematographers all deserve a round of applause for a show like Hannibal for pretty much everything I see in that show. At this lecture, that Damon guy shows up again, and it's post-lecture, and that the dick in the episode, Professor Sogliato, is talking with Lecter, and Damon kind of seems to, well, he doesn't seem to, he totally goes along with the pretense of Lecter's lie. You know, he's referring to him as, you know, Dr. Fell, and how he knows him and worked with him, whatever. So we're kind of wondering what's going on here, or at least Lecter is. He's doing that sizing him up thing again. I gave him a break the other day for dinner. Once this happened, I was like, "Oh, dude, you just bought yourself a ticket to the, you know, a meat hook somewhere." Huh. Oh, and then again, we get a joke when he makes a comment to him about how he probably found Dr. Phil as distasteful as I did, and Lecter says, "On the contrary." And I was like, oh, you card, you. but during that lecture, Bedelia left. You know, Lecter noticed the empty chair. And then we see she's at home. She's preparing to run away. She's packed her big bag. She's heading for the door. And right when she's nearing the door, we see that doorknob turning. And Lecter and Damon come in. They seem to have quite the little sense of purpose when they walk through the door. Now, the only reason I want to mention again, we come out of commercial, because they do something very strange here. When they come out of commercial, they immediately have Lecter smashing Damon over the head with this small bust of Aristotle. It was a very interesting choice to do that. Did you notice? Did you realize that when you were watching without the commercials, how strange that was?
Yeah, it felt kind of like, you know, abrupt.
Yeah, it was like
the word. It was just jarring, I guess, is more than anything.
Well, it's interesting because they decided to not have any of the what I guess would have been the expected buildup of, okay, when's he going to do something? When's he going to reach for that item, whether it be a bust or a knife or whatever, and do it? I like that they said, we all know what's going to happen. Let's just get to it. Let's just do it right. Let's just start off with it, because what's important about the scene is not whether or not, or when Lecter is going to kill this guy. It's about the relationship with Bedelia and how she's going to be a part of it or not. Because he asks her if she's just going to watch, or is she going to get involved? Is she observing, or is she participating? And then we get this whole back and forth between them. You know, he starts questioning her thoughts, her counter thoughts, her rationalizations, all these things that she's done or that she said over however amount of time they've spent together. Again, I'm guessing this has been at least a few months at this point. They never give us an exact amount of time they've been together, but I'm going to guess 3 months. Just throw it out there. I have no idea. But he comes to define everything that she has done so far as participation. Because I think they referenced earlier in the episode, other than obviously Roman, it's not like he hasn't been killing people since he's been on holiday in Paris and Italy. I mean, he does say that, doesn't he? That he does allude to the fact that he's killed people, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to make sure I didn't misunderstand that. Anyway, so they're having this whole... this is what the scene... I know it's a serious scene. And it's dramatic and it's important. But I kind of had to laugh a little bit. I was chuckling like during this whole scene, you know, when he's trying to prove to her that she's not just an observer. We're just watching Demond slowly drag his body across the room. You know, I kept thinking, hey, he's like one of those snails on the arm that we saw earlier today. He just ever so slowly. And right when he gets to near the door and he raises his hand up to try to reach the doorknob, I like that Lecter just walks over and snaps his neck. The guy is a total afterthought to the scene, and I just kind of love that. And speaking of humor, at that point when Lecter turns and says to her, "What have you gotten yourself into, Bedelia?" I really laughed. That had this great this beautiful melodramatic feeling that it could have been out of like a 40s costume drama or something. What have you gotten yourself into, Bedelia? I just thought that was funny.
And it's stuff like that, what they did here, that really elevates this show over like the standard show for me. I mean, like another show, I mean, they would have drugged us out for a while. They would have had the, you know, Demond character, I mean, trying to blackmail him or be some kind of a, you know, try to be like an acolyte of them or something, and they would have, you know, kept it around for a while. I mean, they definitely took some time to, you know, develop the character a little bit in this episode, and just, you wouldn't expect, you know, a typical show would just, you know, drag it out for a while, but here it's just like, nope, boom, you know, escalate it, done, move on.
Right, because it's not about this guy, you know.
Yeah.
This episode is about these two people, and he's one of the more well-developed plot devices I've seen on a show in a little while, but that really is what he is. He's there more to facilitate the situation between them and truly making her clearly an accomplice to his actions. Because, you know, every minute she doesn't do something, that she doesn't do something to try to change her situation, to try to tell anyone about it, well, then she is that much more of an accomplice. Either she's willing or not, you know. You start wondering, because she doesn't seem to have the Stockholm Syndrome thing going on. She seems to be very aware of things and what kind of person he is or what kind of monster he is. I sound like Cade there. But
this goes back to what you were saying earlier about Hannibal, spoiler alert, if you want to watch it. But, I mean, this is similar to the kind of stuff that he was, you know, doing when he was having this type of relationship with Clarice there.
Right, in which, again... spoiler, if you want to read the book, even though I'm telling you not to, so skip a minute. The problem in the book was that the situation happens between him and Clarice, but she totally just falls totally under his control. And she becomes like this mindless numbnut for a good chunk of time. And I hated that. I hated that they ruined her character. And even though it gets a little bit better later on, I never believed the situation between those two characters. I don't want to talk about it. I hate that book so much. Anyway, you know, it's you know, I'd rather watch Prometheus than read that book.
Ooh.
I would. I honestly would. I can say more positive things about Prometheus than I can about the second half of the book, Hannibal. Anyway. We're so close to the finish line, so let me finish up the episode here. Because we go back to... Well, actually, we don't. Here's the thing about when do things take place in this episode. Because then we see Lecter on a train by himself, and like he's thinking... And it seems like he's thinking about all these things. So I'm kind of thinking that the moment we see him on the train, that's as close to present day as we get. I could be totally wrong about that, but that's the feeling I got from the placement of that moment in the episode.
I wasn't really sure where exactly what they were showing there. But it was definitely, you know, unless he's just riding on a train, like, you know, in town, you know, just like she was, you know, bouncing around the subways or whatever. Maybe it was something like, I had that thought too, but it could have been some kind of, you know, like a flash forward to, you know, 6 episodes down the line when maybe he has to bail out on Florence or.
Right. But when he's on the train, this is also the close. Excuse me. A little bit of whiskey and lemonade there. This is probably the closest we get to a moment where you can imagine the character is actually remembering something. So the flashback we get is actually connected to a character's thoughts at that moment. Because it seems like he's on the train, he's looking out the window, he's thinking, and then we go to black and white and him with Gideon yet again. Where he's actually cooking. He's cooking the snails, there's flames everywhere, flames. And what I kind of liked in this scene was the moment where Gideon says to him that, I'm just fascinated to know how you'll feel when all of this happens to you. It's a great line. And when Gideon says that, he's not saying it literally. He doesn't mean that Lecter is actually going to be eaten by someone else. Although that would be interesting. He's saying it metaphorically. Because when Lecter is revealed to everyone else and they're going after him and they're basically taking him apart, because someone like him, you can imagine, oh, they'll probably cut you up and study your brain because you're such a bizarre psychopath. This is what he's talking about, that he'll be prodded and picked at and studied like a specimen, you know, once he's captured. That's the way I took it, at least. So I thought that was kind of a cool little moment. I like that Gideon could get these lines in, because obviously he's going to die. I mean, he's dying bit by bit. But at least, because I guess Lecter hasn't cut them off yet, hasn't yet, at least he's got balls still. He may not have legs. He may only have one arm, which, by the way, makes eating a lot of fun, I could see. I kept thinking, I guess he's not going to give him anything to eat that requires him to cut. So I really like those scenes. I didn't know Eddie Izzard was going to be in the season at all. So I don't know if he's only in this one episode, and that might be it. But I enjoyed seeing him yet again. And we snap out of black and white back into color, and we're Lecter on that train again. But you see, he's got this picture of it's Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, that famous, very 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 famous drawing, and he kind of fashions it into a little, I guess I would call it like an origami heart. Is it origami or origami? Who cares? You know what I mean. Origami. And then we see inside, I don't know if we know what cathedral it is. I think it might have been the cathedral I just mentioned from that article, that there is on display a headless and limbless torso, which has been skinned and mounted on this tripod. I can only assume that's the body of Demand. I don't know who else it might have been at that point.
Right.
And that's the end of the episode. We close on him leaving evidence of his latest masterpiece.
Yeah, what exactly do you think he's doing there? I mean, like, you know, making such a public display of just trying to, you know, I suppose just draw attention to what's going on, just
okay. I thought about that. Well, we saw Lecter do things of this nature in previous seasons when he was kind of taking the lead from other killers and creating his own masterpieces for public display. I'll say there's always been that slight, almost comic book like supervillain element to Lecter, where he is a bit of a show off. You know, he knows he's the smartest guy in the room or in the world, and he likes to prove it. But he fancies himself an artist. He's always, everything he's done has always been with that in mind, I feel at least.
Oh, I get it. He's been watching Game of Thrones, and he's just trying to do, you know, do what the Boltons are doing, but just do it better. Really, you know, really flay those men.
God, I thought we would actually get through the entire podcast without making a Game of Thrones reference. Yeah, something like that. But also, I think I know he's with Bedelia, but I don't know how else to say this. I think he's a little lonely for a certain Will Graham. Huh. And You do something like this, it gets noticed. And even though it's in a foreign country, something like that will make its way back to the States. You know,
yeah, whenever, yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Serial killer stuff, wherever it's happening, we're always on the lookout for it. I do even recall many, many years ago, it might have been before he wrote Hannibal. I think it was before he wrote Hannibal. Thomas Harris, the author, who had been known as being somewhat of a recluse. I mean, not exactly J.D. Salinger, but he wasn't Stephen King either. You know, he wasn't like everywhere. People rarely ever got a chance to speak to him or interview him or whatever. Let me get to the point. He actually had traveled to Italy. I'm just remembering this off the top of my head right now. To be in the courtroom, and they were having it was an ongoing trial of some serial killer of some kind. Some guy who was a well-known lunatic who was killing people in these really bizarre ways in Italy. And Thomas Harris went there to watch the trial. I guess he was looking for inspiration for, I would say it would be for Hannibal, though I didn't really see anything in Hannibal that really would have connected to that. But it definitely had to inform his writing, and maybe we're seeing elements of that here with Lecter himself actually doing things in Italy. I mean, as far as what they're inspired by, obviously Thomas Harris doesn't really have anything to do with this series, but... again, this is what happens when I riff. I don't know where I'm going with it, but anyway, I thought it was an interesting fact, so there you have it.
Yeah.
So, at this point, I mean, I think from what I said during the course of discussing the episode, I think I was pretty clear on what's going on. I mean, the confusing thing about the episode is that it's told out of order. The time is jumbled. But if you know that now, and you were to go back and watch it, then you know what's going on. We're watching their relationship. We're seeing how they built their bond, and we're seeing how it's been tested and how it's starting to break apart, but we're just not seeing it in the order of events. But by the time we get to the end of the episode, that is, I do believe we are current when we get to the end of the episode. I'm assuming the rest of the episodes will not be told in this fashion. So, but I like that they did that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, presumably they're going to, maybe the next episode, they're going to start to show everybody else. So I could see them maybe using a similar structure as they just, you know, bounce around to people's recovery, or, you know, if one person's dead and he's flashing back to somebody's funeral, and then having some kind of like, you know, trippy vision of him after the fact or whatever they decide to do. So
they could. Here's why I don't think they'll do something quite like that. Because if you start repeating that pattern, then it's kind of a one-trick pony kind of deal. It's like, oh, we're going to do that again. That doesn't mean that they won't do something a little bit like that. You know, because I think once we catch up with what happened to Will Graham and Jack Crawford, my assumption is we'll catch them now and we'll get flashes of the time in between. I don't know if we're going to be hopping around for an entire episode of Will Graham flashes and then have one for Jack Crawford as well. Definitely not Jack Crawford. Oh, by the way, is Jack Crawford's wife, did she pass away yet, or is she still alive?
I believe she's still alive, even though, depending on the amount of time that's passed between the bloodbath and this, there's a chance that she's dead by now. But I suspect that we'll you know, at least see her one more time, even if it's in some flashback in between now and then.
Yeah, I'm very curious what they're going to do with the Jack Crawford situation, because... obviously, he's always been an important character in all the stories, you know, before this show. And, you know, you have Lawrence Fishburne playing him. But I think Lawrence Fishburne is on another TV show. I think he's on, is it Blackish? I don't know if he's a recurring character on that or if he's in only some of the episodes. I don't watch it myself, so I don't know. I don't know if that might impact his time on Hannibal or not, or maybe he might only be in select episodes. Although, if a lot of the episodes take place in Italy, at least the first half of the season, maybe there won't be much reason to use him. I don't know. That's. I guess we'll just wait and see.
Do you want to know any information I have on this? It's just minor, not really.
If it's not really spoilery, then feel free.
It's not spoilery, but when I went on iTunes last night, because I was pissed off and I was just going to try to buy the episode because I wanted to watch it last night so we could record, I looked it up in the iTunes store or whatever, and, you know, I found there, you know, they have a page for Hannibal season 3, and it was just like a picture of, you know, picture of Will, picture of Jack. So I'm assuming that you know, maybe he'll have, you know, some kind of a, you know, just his normal role where he's in it a lot.
I would think he'd have to be because he's such an important character.
Right.
I mean, he's important.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, if they're showing that he's both characters have survived. Assuming they, I don't know, I'm just going to assume that, you know, they're both going to want to, you know, get, you know, revenge or something somehow, but do it in different ways. But maybe if, you know, Will's off doing his own thing and Jack's trying to, you know, do whatever he's got to do his own way, maybe they'll have killed his wife, you know, off relatively close to this point, just to kind of, you know, ramp up the level as to what's going on with Jack, you know, where he's coming from right now and what he's doing. Or they'll have, you know, her, like, you know, like right there near the end, and that'll just, you know, add more stress to it. I don't know.
Well, I'm assuming, although they obviously don't need to adhere to the books necessarily, I do know, if I recall, there was always a running thing with Lecter contacting or saying things to Jack about his wife, about her in her final days, about her dying, and then after she died. So I can't imagine they would lose or miss the opportunity to do that. Although we've already had Lecter really insinuating himself into that relationship already, so they've kind of really covered that ground to a certain extent. But I still feel they may go there again. It's interesting because I do enjoy the fact that I'm not really sure what they're going to do. Because I know where things would be if these were the books, but they've gone in a different direction, so I'm not clear on how they're going to get where they need to get. But I'm looking forward to it because, well, I already, you know, love the show, and the fact is that by the time we get to the second half of the season, it's my understanding, just based on episode titles, that we're going to be getting into some territory and some storylines that I am going to be very excited about. I'm actually not going to say anything else about them because even if it's extremely mildly spoilery, it still feels like it is, so I don't want to say anything just yet. I'm very excited about it. There will be characters I am looking forward to seeing on the show. There are going to be characters I'm looking forward to seeing again on this show, which I'm thrilled to see show up at some point later this season. I am very excited about where this season could possibly go. And yeah, there's so much fertile ground to cover. And the fact that it's not even about the original books anymore. Because they're definitely doing things which I don't know where they're going to go. And oh, yeah. I'm excited about that.
And once they shot Dr. Chilson in the face, it kind of made it pretty clear that, you know, anything could happen.
I would just say don't make too much of the fact he got shot in the face.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I mean, even if he survived, he still got a hole in his face. So.
Yes, that's true. Maybe he'll whistle. All right. I'm sorry. Go on.
Were you pleased with the episode as a whole? Did it do everything you wanted to do? Were you disappointed at all that, I mean, we left this just insane cliffhanger and then really didn't resolve any of that? We have to wait at least another week. Did you have any issues with that, or were you just kind of happy with the way they did?
I would say that I would be lying if I said I didn't want to see something about what happened last season. I would be a lie, because obviously we've talked about this, that probably the most horrific cliffhanger of any show we saw in the last year, or end of any season we saw last year, was the end of Hannibal. So the fact that the first episode back would pretty much, except for one little reference, not touch on it at all. I mean, I don't want to reference yet another TV show we've both watched over the years and have talked about ad nauseum over the years, but it did remind me of some show we used to watch that used to be on ABC that dealt with sci-fi and fantasy and weirdness, where we were waiting for things to be resolved in the first episode and they kept making us wait to get to where we wanted to get.
Flash Forward was a very frustrating show to watch. You're definitely right.
Flash Forward. Oh boy. Anyway, in case anyone wasn't picking up on it, I was not talking about Flash Forward. I was talking about Lost. Anyway, back to your question. I was a little disappointed initially that I didn't get to see what happened with them, but I was so taken with the artistic nature of this episode, but it was well done and pulled off. You made a great reference earlier to when The Walking Dead tried to do something of a more artsy nature, and they tried to get their Terrence Malick on or something, and it really didn't work all that well, at least as far as we were concerned. This show, I mean, I will say maybe every once in a while they get a little bit too pretty. You know, maybe I could have had one or two less shots of water splashing. But
I read some stuff about the show today, you know, after I've watched the episode. I read a few of the reviews and stuff. And one of the things, I'm not sure where it was, but it said that Brian Fuller tells the any new directors to the show, like he tells them that, like, he expects them to film the episode like it's a pretentious art piece. That's how he tells new directors that's how he wants the show shot. So it has its own kind of show.
If that, you know what, if that's what he's going for, then kudos to him, because there's at least two moments in this episode he certainly pulled it off. Because I remember going, there were moments that if they just went on just a little bit longer, my eyes would have been rolling. But they stopped it just short of that. Whereas, and it moved to the next moment with enough time where I was like, oh, that was just pretty without being stupid. So anyway, yeah, I enjoyed the episode. It was gutsy, but it gave Bedelia a lot to do. It built up her character. It showed us a lot of lovely real Italian exteriors and fake Italian interiors, apparently. But you know what I like the most about this episode? Is that since it centered so much just on this and nothing else, it means I have one more. Then I look forward to the next episode just as much as I was looking forward to this one, because it's the I gotta know what happened mode. So it's like I was waiting to open my Christmas presents, and then I found out, you know what? We're going to make it wait till New Year's now. It's like, no! Like, no. No, you got to wait another week. No, no. With that present, it's so pretty. But no.
Yeah, I kind of ran a similar trajectory to you there, where, I mean, you know, I figured out relatively early on that they weren't going to go back to resolve this cliffhanger stuff pretty much at all. But, and then I was mildly just like, oh, you know, I've been waiting so long, and that was just crazy. But then the more I thought about it, the more it just worked for me. I mean, this episode was filled with stuff. I mean, you know, Hannibal and Bedelia moved to a different country, two different countries. I mean, there was a lot going on. If they had tried jamming in some of this other stuff with, you know, four characters that were mortally wounded, I mean, it's glad that they're just taking their time setting up this stuff, and they can maybe, you know, maybe they'll, maybe, I mean, for all we know, you won't even see Hannibal for a few episodes, and they'll just focus on stuff back there. I mean, you don't know what they're going to do. So it's, which is nice, because, I mean, they could do anything like that. Just they've set it up so effectively. They've set up, you know, Hannibal's position here in Florence, where you, if you didn't see him for a couple episodes, it would be okay.
Right.
So I like that they're not just ramming stuff in there.
Well, to quote the character again from, well, once again, I'll reference Silence of the Lambs. One of Lecter's lines in that movie was, "All good things to those who wait." So we've just got lots of good things to be waiting for, both next week and for the rest of the season. I did watch the trailer for the rest of the season, which I liked the trailer because it didn't, other than maybe one little flash of something, it didn't really reveal that much, because it was just so much disjointed, holy crap, what kind of stuff going on in it. But yeah, I'm glad we're podcasting about it. I know this podcast was more of an introductory one, so we got to discuss the character and the stories in general, but the rest of the podcast will be centered just on the actual episodes themselves. But
right,
hopefully folks enjoyed this podcast. Hopefully we might have helped a few people who are having any problems figuring this one out, and hopefully those folks will stick with us for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I wasn't really sure how this is going to go, because it's a different kind of show than what we normally talk about. I mean, it's just different than what we've been doing, so I didn't really know what to expect. Or even if we'd end up, you know, I didn't know we'd end up talking about it for over an hour. I guess I should know between the two of us that there's no way anything's ever going to be under an hour.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not complaining.
I'm trying to not comment on that, because I know you get annoyed with me that I comment on that a lot.
No, I don't get annoyed with you. I just figure, I mean, you know, we're both intelligent people. Sometimes you more so than me. I hate to admit it. But if we're going to say intelligent, you know, if we're saying stuff that's decent, and, you know, I've never heard a single listener on our Facebook group or anywhere complain about the length of the episode and the any of the episodes, even the really, really long ones. So it's okay. It's fine.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, and speaking of our listeners, and this is my segue to get to the point of ending the podcast. If you did enjoy this podcast, if you enjoy us, well, you know, never mind. No one enjoys us. But if you enjoyed the podcast, then you can find us on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in, join the page, join the conversation. Shows like Hannibal and Mad Men and The Flash and pretty much every show that's on TV, with a couple of exceptions, but we don't need to get into that here. Better still, if you'd like to track us down on iTunes, again, the Serious TV Drama Podcast, if you just start typing in Serious TV Drama, you'll find us that way. That's what happens when I type us in, I've noticed. You can hit us up with a 5-star review. The more reviews we get, the higher profile we can acquire in searches that people will do. Because now, obviously, when people are searching for a Hannibal podcast, we're hoping that we can land in the top, I don't know, 100, 150. I have not even looked to see how many podcasts there are about Hannibal. I'm assuming there's plenty.
Well, yeah, and if you're a Hannibal fan and just found this because you were looking for a podcast for the new season and you've never listened to us before, well, you know, thanks for listening, and we, you know, we'll go back and look through our backlog, and if you thought we were tolerable this week, we've put out some good content. So if it's a show that you like, you know, give it a listen. At the very least, we got pretty music playing at the beginning and end,
right?
With some interesting prattling and lisping going on in between.
Yes, we are, at the very least, we are often tolerable and quite often competent. And that would be how I would review us. By the way, we actually did get we got an uptick of one more rating and one more review the other day. I was like, oh, look at that, finally. That's me being an ingrate. We finally got one. But anyway, so that's it. So I'm looking forward to the next podcast. It's... Wow, we started at night and we're ending it in the morning. It's not quite breakfast time yet, but I am starting to get a little peckish here.
Yeah, well, if I live closer to you, maybe I'd come over and go through your freezer. I think you still got some of that Middle Eastern lamb in your freezer, right?
Yeah, the problem is that it's not lamb.
Oh, well,
You know, yeah. It's got all these curly black hairs on it I have to remove first.
I don't think I can even say anything to that. I just...
Oh, come on. It sounds delicious.